Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
I don't want a lot for Christmas.
Happy birthday, Jesus! 7 major milking, 6 major milking, 5 major milking!
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. Next, we'll be Talking Twilight Zone.
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. And this is Talking Twilight Zone. I'm your host, Lynn. And I'm here with my co-host, Bobby, Robert, and Dave. Hi, guys.
Howdy.
Hi. Hello. And hello. Welcome to our special show. Ain't that special?
It's special. It's special. Special. This is our last show before Christmas, and then we'll be back on January 4th with our next show. And I do hope everyone is going to have a very happy Christmas, and hope you're all done your shopping by now and sending out your cards and letters and everything that has to be done, and you're decorating. And this is a great time of year. I love Christmas. Don't like the snow too much, but I do like Christmas, and we didn't have much snow, just a little bit here. But today, we
now it's rain. Rain.
Tomorrow, we're supposed to get rain tomorrow night, though, actually. I have to drive into New Jersey to see my cousins tomorrow to make my Christmas visit. So
we're going to Jersey.
Going to Jersey, and what I exit? I don't remember the exit, but I go over the Delaware Memorial Bridge to Red Bank, so like Woodbury, New Jersey, thoroughfare, that area.
No, I actually it's a big joke here in New York when people go, "Oh, I'm from Jersey." Really? What exit?
I can tell you, but I do know that it's
I know this is a little delayed, but this is for you, Rick.
Thank you.
No problem.
That's right outside of Philadelphia. It takes 30 minutes to get here from Philly. So hopefully it won't be raining till tomorrow evening. So and Felix is here. I do want to welcome our guest. Felix just showed up. Good evening,
Felix.
To you too, Felix. And Rick,
hey, Felix.
Our loyal listener, Rick, and our other loyal listener, Lou. And we have Ara Boros. Hello. Oh, around Zoidy, Zoid, and Zoid. Oh, okay. Hello, Ara Boros. So it's great to see everyone here. And today we're going to be talking about another season five, or season, I'm sorry, season four, hour-long
episode. Hey, how you wish,
yes. And it's called The Late, I Think, of Clifford Bell, and I'm going to turn it over to Robert for our opening clip.
Okay, but first, this.
Mr. Serling.
Witness a murder. The killer is Mr. William Feathersmith, a robber baron whose body composition is made up of a refrigerant plant covered by thick skin. In a moment, Mr. Feathersmith will proceed on his daily course of conquest and calumny with yet another business dealing. But this one will be one of those bizarre transactions that take place in an odd marketplace known as the Twilight Zone.
Hey, thank you, Robert, for the barking dogs. I love it. This is dogs singing jingle bells. I love it. And that's always been one of my favorites. I don't play that on the radio too much anymore. They used to. I haven't heard it. I've been listening to Christmas songs for the past couple of weeks on the radio and haven't played that one. So I really should protest the radio stations for that. I should call them and say, play it.
About 12 o'clock, 104.3 did.
Really? Aw,
yeah.
See, I haven't heard it here. Well, see, New York, they would do that, yeah, because they're more, attuned to that kind of stuff. They didn't do it here, but they really should. But anyway, today we're talking about Of Late, I Think, of Clifford Bell. And, here we go again. We have another guy. He's unhappy with his current life. He's only a multimillionaire. You know, who can blame him, right? William Feathersmith is his name. I think that's a cool name. I like the name. But he's just a nastier, colder, creepier version of Martin Sloan and Gart Williams from Walking Distance and A Stop at Willoughby. The only difference is that Sloan and Williams, they wanted to go back to simpler times, to live a happier, more contented life, and we actually could feel sorry for those guys. But Feathersmith, he wanted to go back to his past so that he could work his way up the ladder again and kick everyone in the teeth on his way up, just as he had done before. I mean, he wasn't a very nice man at all. In fact, he was a total
humbug.
Humbug. He was a total horse's ass. He really was. And there were also a couple things I didn't get in this story. I mean, first of all, you know, one of his stipulations to Miss Devlin was that the town and all the people be the same as they were in the past, okay? And she agreed to that. Therefore, I didn't understand why his lady love, Miss Gibbons, wasn't the beauty she was supposed to be. I mean, he said that she was this gorgeous woman, and she turned out to be a beast. And so I figured, you know, that she'd still be a beauty, but would completely spurn him and leave him devastated. But the dumbfounded expression on Albert Zombie's face in that scene was hysterical. He looked as though someone had just sucker punched him, and in a way they did. But that part I didn't get, because if everything was supposed to be the same, if everything was supposed to be the same, she should have been a beauty. But
make
I had
to deal with the devil, you'd never do it.
That's right. You can't trust those damn devils.
No, but they did explain it because they said it was basically his memory was wrong. He had this idyllic memory of what she looked like, when in reality, going back, she wasn't. It was kind of like, He created this false image of her.
So she wasn't the beauty that he
portrayed
her to be?
No. The thing is that I think he just remembered her as this beauty. It's just that his memory was wrong. Julie Newmar says that. It says, and it's not my fault that, you know, your memory isn't what you thought it was going to be.
Oh, gosh.
His memory probably was that she was the route to wealth. You know, one way of getting the wealth was to marry the banker's daughter.
I missed that.
His perception of her. Yeah.
I totally missed that. I've seen this episode so many times, I totally missed that. I thought that part, that she had basically screwed him on that part, you know, where he just, you know, he went back and she wasn't the beauty that she was supposed to be. But, well, anyway.
Also, he probably saw her, you know, he was in love with her and everything like that. And he saw her, you know, idealized her because he loved her so much.
In other words, love is blind, right?
Well, yeah. it was only when she opened her mouth that she went. I mean, if she, he'd only seen her from a distance, and but it was,
you're saying that she should be quiet. She wouldn't have spoke.
Oh, yes, sir.
Maybe a bottle of wine would have helped him, Dave.
It helped me. Yeah.
But you have to admit that look on his face. He's sitting there with his mouth open. It was like, this is like a classic scene. It was just
have you got another daughter?
Yeah.
I love that.
Oh, my God. Yeah, love is blind, I guess, you know. But I do have to say, Salmi did give his usual good performance. That obnoxious, raspy voice he used, that was a little over the top. And his evil laugh. Well, that was as sinister as they come, and that was a little overdone, too. But, you know, almost everyone got to give a sinister laugh in this episode. I thought Salmi came across much better when he was portraying his younger self, even though he was still a jerk. But, you know, he's always good. I just think he was a very good actor. And Julie Newmar, she played her part to perfection. I suppose they figured the old selling your soul bit had been done to death by now, because I couldn't understand what the devil was going to do with money. But, you know, that was, I guess, something that they just decided to do differently on this one. And I suppose they figured, you know, the one little item, well, to me, the one little item that was rather implausible in the story was that the custodian, Mr. Hecate or whatever, he just happens to be from Cliffordville, too. So you've got Feathersmith, that guy Diedrich, who was played by John Anderson, and Hecate. They all hail from this little town in Indiana. You know, not very believable, but, you know, I guess they have to take their little liberties there. And, of course, you know, Feathersmith was a total, you know, horse's ass to Hecate and just about everybody. But I thought one great little touch were the horns around Miss Devlin's hat. They perfectly matched the two jutting out of her pretty little head. And as usual, the she-devil, she has the standard contract to sign, just as we saw in Escape Clause and Printer's Devil. And now, here's a little something that many of you may not have noticed, but I did after, it took me a couple of viewings or two or three viewings on this in the past to notice it, but after Feathersmith leaves her office, he immediately turns back to see that the office has disappeared. But the board that shows the floor directory, it still lists Devlin's travel agency on it. So it's about four places down from the top. So the continuity guy missed that one, but, you know. Yeah, to be expected. And speaking of Willoughby, as I mentioned earlier, I'm sure a lot of people immediately thought of that episode when the conductor in this story yells out, "The stop is Cliffordville, Cliffordville," and Feathersmith yells, "Cliffordville?" I mean, it just reminds you of Willoughby. I mean, I thought of that anyway. And, oh, by the way, was anyone else appalled by the horrible job the makeup crew did on Albert Salmi? The bald cap was awful. I mean, the seam was painfully noticeable. That ball cap was terrible. I don't know who was in charge of the makeup on that for that episode, but they really did a bad job. And, you know, there was some overacting in the episode, but I didn't think it was that bad. I really didn't think it was terrible. The plot line was a familiar one, but the cast was worth watching. It was Salmi's, I think, third Zone episode. And, of course, the wonderful John Anderson. He appeared in four Zone episodes, including one of my favorites, The Odyssey of Flight 33. Julie Newmar, this was her only Zone episode. And she went on to play the memorable role of Catwoman on the TV series Batman. So I don't think this is a terrible episode. I really don't. It's long. It's slow in some places. Usual fillers there always to annoy us in season four. But the story isn't awful. The ending alone makes it worth watching. Seeing Feathersmith get what he deserves was satisfying. The tables were definitely turned, and it was good to see. And, you know, sadly, Albert Sahmi, he did meet a bad end in real life. He murders his wife in 1990, and then he committed suicide. So it was a tragic ending and the great loss of, or the loss of a great talent. But I didn't think this was bad, so I'm giving it a 2.5. So, Robert, over to you.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. Yeah, one of the things I mentioned when I'm reviewing this episode was very much how Rod seems to love using the template of It's a Wonderful Life or Scrooge in some of his stories. And it seems to be, you know, since we have Christmas around the corner here, it very much, the character of Feathersmith is like a Scrooge character. And the way, you know, he's moved about, going back to the past, kind of reminds you of It's a Wonderful Life, which is kind of funny because It's a Wonderful Life, and you know how it always gets its yearly airing on TV. It was on last night. So, got to watch the part where the Jimmy Stewart character is saying, you know, I wish he was never born, and then he's looking for his car is not there. So that takes off from there. But she's all seen it, you know, time after time again, knows how it's, how, you know, it all ends. So, but, you know, I think the devil must have been bored and decided to trick on Mr. Feathersmith just to get him riled up. And the point that I want to bring up is if the devil has his soul, which, you know, she mentions that, why, you know, do Feathersmith any favors? Why not give him a heart attack and be done with him?
Yeah.
It's not really a favor.
Hmm. Well, a devil might admire that sort of trait of being merciless and nasty. They might have a secret admiration for the guy. They probably wish more people were like that.
Well, that's true, because he was nasty.
I don't know. I don't remember she said she had a hard time using the word sympathy.
Another point two, why would the devil need millions of dollars?
Mm-hmm.
Was the purpose to teach him a lesson on humility, you know, being, you know, humility? You know, why would the devil do that for? I mean, you know.
It was all he had left of value.
Yeah.
You know, I originally thought that maybe the devil was trying. I thought that she was sending him back so that he could be even worse than he was, like, the first time around and create even more, like, even more worse world. But that didn't happen, and
you thought
she
was doing it for her benefit.
Yeah, and the only other thing I could think of was that the one innocent character in the episode is that the guy who's been the cleaning guy for the top three. He becomes evil at the end, presumably. So maybe another soul got tinged by the devil, but now it becomes this kind of loop because what's his name is now kind of like, I don't know, I'll call him the innocent, but he's now the cleaning guy for the top three floors, and seems like a very humble character. I'm not even sure if he remembers what happened from the
like
way he
acts. Like a vicious cycle. Yeah, a vicious cycle.
So that doesn't really work with why the devil would do it. I think it was just, you know, it was just a plot contrivance, I think.
And my other point is, Ferris Smith must have been terrible history, and the example Lynn was about, you know, the young lady that he thought was, you know, a goddess and turns out to be homely, so to say, as we call him.
Beast.
Yeah. I mean, he must have been terrible history in school, or it's the old age settling in, you know. But
like I said, love is blind.
Really blind.
I mean, even the switch at the end seems to be no improvement on character, because Hecate seems to turn out the same way as Feathersmith. They just switch places.
Yeah.
And maybe the office building's cursed. Who knows? Or at least the life of a tycoon is being cursed.
Mm-hmm. No, I said that's a good point. I didn't think about that, about it being cursed,
I mean, we find out that he never the man who creates, but he's the one who takes. And Miss Devlin points that out to him. You know, he ought to have known
that 1910 was way too early to be helpful with any results. I mean, why not start in the 30s and wait out the next few years? You know, if he had a business degree, you know, he should have studied engineering. In other words, Saint
because
was
then
to
he couldn't, yes, fine, he waits till the 1930s or 40s. Fine. Then he has to pay $300 an acre instead of 20 cents or whatever it was, 10
cents. Well, we couldn't have, he was also tricked because he had a 30-year-old looking body, but he still had his 75-year-old body. He didn't have the energy. He couldn't have rebuilt his empire. That's why he pled, he asked for mercy, because he realized she tricked him on that one.
He looked 30 to the people in Cliffordville, but he was 70, so we know who the character is, okay?
Yeah.
It's a trick that they do all the time in TV.
Sorry, Rick. Well, he looked 35 to us. They didn't leave him with his ball makeup on. If they were going to do it that way, he would have still looked his old age to us, you know, a la Quantum Leap, but he didn't. He looked 30 to us. He looked 30 to them. It was just that
he did. All right.
They did say that, like, his insides, like she said, his kidneys, his lungs, they're all of a 70-year-old man. She only changed his outward appearance.
Okay, I forgot.
Well, he would have probably died in 10 or 20 years anyway. I mean, he could have lived to be 120, I suppose, but time
it's
was
like
not
the next
Gen
Tapestry episode with Picard going back to his Academy days. Yeah, so very much like that one. Satan was saying, you know, he should have been a builder instead of a taker is what I'm seeing the beginning from this episode, you know. You should have knew ahead of time that this stuff wasn't going to be there when you got there. And, you know, have the stuff made yourself and then later on take the profits and stuff like that. But here again, and why would the devil want to, you know, show that lesson to Feathersmith? That's just the whole thing. I mean, the story reminds me of Bedazzled again with Brent Fraser, Elizabeth Hurley. And, you know, something that always seems to be out in these Twilight Zone episodes is you need to specify what you want. You know, Feathersmith not specifying wanting to be 30 inside and out. And, you know, this episode was very reminiscent of Back to the Future and Fringe, especially season 4. So
You've got to specify every detail.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
My main disappointment is Miss Devlin. I would love to have seen more of her in this episode. She was perfect. She was perfect. Should have been dispersed more in the second half of the episode. It would have been nice to see her popping in and out of the story, taunting them more. I mean, she was great in the role of the Catwoman in the old Batman series. So,
she's a beautiful woman.
Yeah. I mean, all in all, this episode was okay. I give it a 2.5 out of 5, which is above average for this episode. So.
That's what I gave it.
I'll pass it over to Bobby. Bobby?
Oh, do I have to?
I can play some music while you want to wait. You want to play some music while you wait?
If this takes me more than 2 minutes, I'll be amazed. It's the same old, same old. How many more episodes do I have to sit through about the devil and people making deals with the devil and being sorry for it over and over and over and over and over again? And just, you know, there's just nothing here. There's just the series is completely bereft of any new ideas. It has none. I know Lynn hates when I say this, but I think the series should have ended after 3 seasons.
No.
Yes.
No.
I thought it was my turn to talk. The series should have ended after 3 seasons because they had done the best they could have done. And it's all about, like life itself, it's about quality, not quantity.
But remember what you'd miss out on. Remember
well,
what you'd miss
I understand
out on.
That I would miss Living Doll and Nightmare 20,000 Feet. I understand that. But this is too much agony to sit through just to get to 2 other episodes. And then, of course, you know, then when we get to the end of the series in season 5, it really peters out into nothing. It really just dies completely right in front of you. So there's no new ideas. And I think that today's cable TV, although I despise cable TV too, has a better idea when they do a limited run series. They have a certain number of episodes in mind. They do them, If it's one season, two, three, whatever it is, they do their story and they get out before it's too late. And unfortunately, this wasn't the case back then. And it shows week after week after week after week. This season four thing just goes on forever. I've never seen anything last this long. And we're still not at the end yet. So this particular episode, I'm really shocked at our group, the Twilight Zone Revisited and Reviewed, where everybody who reviewed this episode gave it a 2.5, like Robert just did. You've got to be kidding me. We recently did the new exhibit, which we all agreed was a pretty good episode for season four, and everybody gave it a 3 for good. And you're going to tell me that this story is only a 0.5 worse than that? You're not serious. I mean, it's
well, you're between a 2.5, 3, Bobby. But...
Now you're pushing it up to 3? It's getting worse by
the
minute?
No, I'm talking about the new exhibit was between a 2.5 and 3. Yeah,
well, I thought that was...
That's why I give that 2.5.
Considering what we have in front of us, that wasn't a bad episode. It was at least watchable.
Yeah.
This is just the same old thing. I've seen this story 1,000 times. And so, you know, the first time you do one of these devil stories is something new. It's interesting. The second time, you can excuse and say, oh, that's a little different twist to it. But then when it goes on and on and on and on and on, it just gets more and more and more ridiculous. And nothing happens in this story. It's just a talk marathon from the minute it starts to the minute it ends. And I must say, as I said in my review at the group, I think Albert Samme probably killed his wife and himself later on in life because he saw this on his resume and he couldn't deal with it. And I don't blame him for that. I would have done that too.
That's terrible.
Man had a pretty good career, but boy, when this is stuck in the middle of it, you got to be embarrassed. And it's already been said by everybody, it's just irritating and annoying. His voice is annoying, and the makeup is horrible, and it just is lousy. That's all. It's just terrible. So I'm really disappointed that Santa, that jolly fat man with the red suit and the beard and that hat, would leave me a lump of coal in my Christmas stocking in the form of this terrible episode. So I'm quite disappointed that he did that. And although, what is that Christmas story in the Twilight Zone early on? What was that, Night of the Meek?
Night of the Meek.
Yeah, I hated that too. So,
Felix was going to watch that. Felix was going to watch it on Christmas Eve. Don't cut that down there.
Well, I'm not going to let him stop him from watching it, but I won't be, that's for sure. So, I mean, that's what is there to say about this? It's just, there's not any... Any idiot who would stand there and make a deal with a woman who has horns growing out of her head is obviously a jackass. So for that reason alone, I don't care what happens to him at all. And what else is there to say about it? Absolutely nothing. But most people gave it 2.5. But it is the Christmas season, and as a way of joining in the frivolity of the season, I don't want to be too much of an ogre. So I'll give it a 2.5, too, only I'll give it a minus 2.5 because I don't think it's even good enough to be 0, to be honest.
You're a Grinch.
So Merry Christmas to everybody, and keep me away from this. And please call me when season 4 is mercifully over, which it still is not.
Bobby,
not
I got a good song for you then.
Okay.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel.
You feel better there, Bobby?
Yes, I fully accept that. But it's a season... Season 4 that made me that way, so I have an excuse. I wasn't always like that.
Oh, God. All right.
No, that's right. But
you were young
episode,
and fancy free at one time.
If I remember correctly, our next episode is even worse than this, so.
Yeah, it is.
I'm not finished yet. All right, Lynn.
All right.
Boys, please. It's Christmas Eve. This is a night for magic and wonder and joy. Okay, so a couple of things have gone wrong, but we can still have a great Christmas.
Ah, jeez, kids. You know, I was this close to losing it, but your mom's right.
Well, sure I am. Meg, honey, get me some paper towels. Let's lose the bad tidings, clean up this mess, and find that holiday cheer.
Yeah, all right.
We're out of paper towels.
No paper towels! Ah!
Hey, I was gonna pick at that.
Shut your fat mouth! You all think Christmas just happens. You think all this goodwill just falls from the freaking sky. Well, it doesn't! It falls out of my holly jolly butt! So you can cook your own damn turkey, wrap your own damn presents, and hey, while you're at it, you can all ride a one-horse open sleigh to hell! Ah!
Oh, here's the paper towels.
Turn it over to Dave.
I'm amazed again, Bob. I mean, you've just said that if it finished at series 3, that's just another 54 episodes you've written off. One third of the whole of Twilight Zone has been not worth watching. I am keeping track, because every time I bring it up, you say you like most of them, and I've yet to hear it much. But anyway, I thought it was good. I mean, first of all, and I think there'll be somebody else in the room the same as me, as soon as the actual words time travel were actually mentioned within the episode, I was going, yay! I mean, they actually mentioned time travel. The devil was offering time travel. So, I mean, simple things like that get me hooked.
And, Dave, how could you resist Miss Devlin flying outside the airplane itself?
And it seamlessly changed quite nicely into a train, didn't it? Well, seamlessly for the day. I think the reason why, you say, why would he do anything with a woman with horns? But he's always got his own way. It starts off with like that. Everything he wants, he gets. His own pride made him think, you know, he's not some greenhorn that she can hoodwink. He was going to, you know, make a cast iron case. He believed he could get the best of her, as he always had with all the people. I hadn't anticipated this thing about him being the old man inside the body until that was explained, because I was wondering why. Well, if that land deal fell through, all he needed to do was fall back on the same grifting that he did the first time round, and he would have been okay. All right, he would have lost that money, but presumably, we've got to assume that the first time round, he basically started with nothing and grafted his way up. He clawed, he scratched. He said that. So I think the reason why they did that was because you just see that he just wouldn't have that survival. He wouldn't be able to do that this time round. One of the flaws I did think about it, though, was, and it was a nice switcheroo when at the table, each of the groups thought they were outdoing the other in terms of that land and what the land was worth. You know, he thought he was fooling them. They were already aware that there was oil on the land, but as far as they were concerned, it was unreachable. But what hurt me somewhat, I mean, they said that they'd had their own inspection done 4 years earlier, and the oil was, it says something like, well, if you can drill 6,000 feet, whatever it was, then you can get the oil. But there's no drill, you know, ever. And then he says to himself, that's right, they didn't invent that drill till 1937, 27 right. years in the future. But the point is, how if they can't drill to 6,000 feet, how were they to know that the oil was that far deep? I mean, presumably, the only way they could find the oil was either the type of stone that was there, or there was actually some oil seeping into the water table, the clam pits, and up through the ground came a bubbling crude. But that wouldn't tell you how deep it was, would it? I mean, you know, when they have things like ultrasonics, where you can actually send sound waves, you know, where what they do is they put two explosions about half a mile apart, and then they have this special machine in the middle. And then it times the sound waves, and if it hits what is called a cyclinorium or something, it's like a dome-shaped area of rock that can actually act like a basin, a container, and entrap the oil in that sort of load-bearing rocks or whatever it is. And they look for that particular thing. I mean, I wouldn't have thought in 1910 they would have been able to know. I mean, they would know about oil near the surface, and of course it's oil near the surface that was not mined, mine's the wrong word, but pumped. So So that was a little bit the thing. At the end, I think we all saw the switch coming at the end. I'm not entirely sure if they made that. I mean, I think you're all right. They said that the caretaker became a nasty man. Well, you could argue, well, that's to do, I would assume, that, you know, power corrupts. When you've had that much power and used to telling people what to do, you lose your compassion. You know, they're on my time, they do what I say, and you become meaner and meaner.
Yeah, you have no empathy for anyone. Yeah.
But I thought this Feathersmith guy was a bit more contrite when he was the janitor, because he was proud that he got a watch. You know, he'd done 44 years. 4 years ago, they gave me the watch, and he seemed quite proud. He wasn't resentful of his boss. He didn't, you know, his demeanour had changed somewhat. But was it Word Forge that said, you know, you could have an endlessly repeating cycle here if the new man in the chair was suddenly approached by the devil. So that's it. The other thing is, you mentioned Lynn and Bobby, and I do agree with Bobby. The plot line has been used quite a lot. Mm-hmm. But one of the episodes that it reminded me of was from season 2, episode 49, Back There. That was the one where the chaps with his...
Goes back to for Lincoln.
Yeah, he's in the club, yeah. But the point is, one of the waiters at the club, the Batman or whatever you want to call it, when he actually comes back at the end, his grandfather or something had been the one person that had believed that the assassination and was going to go, and his parents and his family had actually got money in that. And now, so when he came back to the club, the person who was on the door was now one of their elect few people sitting around the table.
Right,
so
his grandfather, great-grandfather, constable.
Yeah, the police sergeant, yeah. So to me, it was more of a reworking of that. And that was written by Rod Sterling as well, both his stories were. I think it was a little bit overlong. I think what they do now with these longer time slots is that they tell a story to set up a second story, because in effect it was almost, you know, it was like two episodes of a story, wasn't it? There was the whole. It was, I think, when he was the scene that you said where he's going to the. Well, actually, when he's leaving the office the first time, it's about 22, 23 minutes before we actually get into the scene where he's going to be then transported. So you basically got, you know, a two-act play almost, really.
I suppose that's well, he said he wanted it done quickly, so that helped that story along, too. Yeah.
And the other thing I was just going to mention, Robert, when you mentioned Star Trek, is the Star Trek Voyager episode where they had that chap that had 29th century technology, stole it off Janeway and that. And that was even more in the future from Janeway. And he'd got it, without spoiling it too much, there'd been a time agent from the future that told Janeway something, but something that happened had caused this man to crash, and this man on Earth had found this tramp, and he'd got all these, inventions. Now, in this particular case, in that story, unlike this, where, of course, it failed for Feathersmith, because he hadn't got the slightest idea how these inventions were being built. He may have known the dates and what inventions, but he'd been such a businessman and, as this woman said, a taker. He'd never actually sort of pored over the schematics, and he'd never said, well, let's make this, you know, vacuum cleaner a better vacuum cleaner. This, all he wanted to know is, how much can we make it for? How much can we sell it for?
Right,
you know,
all money.
Make 100,000. He probably wouldn't know how it was put together or anything. So he was defeated by his own single-mindedness. And I think the last thing, because I talked too long really already, I think they could have done with making the daughter, the actress who played her, more attractive. They put an enormous great mole on her face or something. but I think they could have made her attractive. And then Allah singing in the rain, can't stand it. You know, they could have had to come out. So as soon as she opened her mouth, then he realized.
He should have had a couple of teeth missing.
Yeah. It would be like if we'd seen her introduced and she looked an absolute picture, and then they got the chocolates out and she's grunting like a pig as she's eating the chocolates. Out, you know. I think they'd give it 3 out of 5. It's got time travel, so 3 out of 5.
Cool. Okay, who wants to go next, Rick or Lou?
Me, because Daphne's going nuts here, wanting to go out. Let's see. What can I say that hasn't really been said?
Yeah, pick the bones, Rick. Pick the bones.
You know, look. If a formula works, why not use it? All right. Yeah, it might be boring, but if it works, why not? Like, I remember I did a story for the school newspaper when I was in college. I interviewed our coach. And in one game, he ran the ball 3 times. And I said, why did you do that? He said, well, I figured after they couldn't stop us the first time, why not? They didn't stop us the second time? Fine. They can't stop us. So I did it a 3rd time.
Makes sense.
And, you know, that's my feeling, too. All right. So, yeah, we've seen this story, quote, unquote, 1,000 times. But it works. People seem to like it. Rod was comfortable writing something like this because, again, it was a morality play. Fine. The acting was, I thought, pretty good.
I thought the acting was good, too.
I like Robert, I wanted to see more of Julie Newmar.
Anybody would.
Yeah.
Especially when I first saw this episode when I was like 10. But, you know, again, with the budget and everything, you saw the budget restrictions, unfortunately. You know, as a matter of fact, myself and a friend of mine just exchanged Christmas gifts Thursday. And he gave me a book of a producer I love and a lot of people can't stand because they said, oh, he made such cheap, awful movies. Roger Corman.
I like Roger Corman.
I do, too.
The Edgar Allan Poe movies I always enjoyed with them.
I had a problem with Roger Corman.
So, you know, and look at the budgets he had.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, he made the Post stuff for like $17,000 a movie.
Well, he was the MacGyver of producers, you might as well say.
Right, but no, I'm just using that as an example. You know, even back then, movies were like in the millions. You know, not hundreds of millions like today, but
thousands. Is he the guy that made the Double D movies with a B budget?
He made movies like
Grand Theft Auto, which is pretty good.
Yeah, Grand Theft Auto.
Death Race. He did Death Race.
Big Round Poe movies.
Death Race, the over Poe movies.
Little Shop of Horrors.
Bucket of Blood.
Oh, yeah, right. Little Shop of Horrors. Yeah, I forgot about that.
He was more sci-fi and horror, like Not of This Earth. He read that about 2 or 3 times.
I thought he was the bloke who made these Vixen movies and that. That's somebody different, is it?
Yeah.
Roger Corman.
That was Herschel, I believe, was his name. I forget it. Bernard Herschel. But, you know.
Russ Myers.
Yes, Russ Myers.
Ah, Russ Myers. Right.
why I said that was, you know, some people can have a minuscule budget and make stuff work. Others can't, and or at least the restrictions show. And unfortunately, this episode happens to be one of the examples of the budget showing, or lack of thereof showing. But I liked it. Again, I'll give it a 3.
Well, you could see it lacking, especially in the makeup department. That's just, pretty bad.
And having said that, she's poking me on the side really hard. She's being very good. She's not making any noise, but I wish you all a Merry Christmas. Oh, by the way, she was bobbing her head and wagging her tail when she heard the song.
Aw, we love you, Daphne. Make sure you send me that picture. I gave you the email address now.
Yes, I will.
NewPony@Comcast.net.
Yep.
All right. Okay. Have
Merry
a Merry Christmas,
Rick.
Merry Christmas.
Happy
everybody.
Holiday, Rick.
Good night.
Yeah. See you in a couple of weeks.
Bye.
January 4th. Bye-bye. Okay, Lou. You're up.
All right. Well, I guess it'll be my Christmas present to Bobby, but I kind of agree with him on this case.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I'm not going to rate it as low as he did. I won't go into the negative numbers. I think the acting was okay. But, you know, there's a saying, right? I mean, Rick was talking about how, you know, if a story works once, why not use it again? For me, it's kind of like, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And, you know, this is a story that's been used over and over again. It's not the first, it wasn't even used in the Twilight Zone exclusively. This is the story that's been done over and over again. And if you're going to do it over again, you should at least try to bring something new to the table. And I think they tried to do that by kind of suggesting that his soul was already the devil's, but the devil had some sort of different reason for doing what she was doing. But it just, for me, it didn't work. I mean, I liked the acting. That was basically it. I just liked the acting from the actors. But the premise and the story, it went a certain way that was expected, and eventually it ended in a way that was kind of expected. And, you know, part of it's that it doesn't make sense why the devil would do this. The devil's never really given a really plausible reason for doing what she's doing. I mean, I didn't understand it. It was brought up before, and I thought of reasons, but they all kind of fall apart when I try to really, you know, think them through. I mean, I don't know. Why did she make a deal with this guy? Why? It made no sense. Does the devil need money? I thought maybe the devil does need money. Maybe there's something about the way she has to do things that she needs cash. And I don't know. But it just...
Perhaps she was trying to corrupt the janitor.
That's what I thought. But then it doesn't work because it just becomes cyclical. And then does that mean that Smith's soul is now saved since he never became this evil person?
No.
And he was a humble person?
He'd already lost his soul.
Is his soul now saved and now it's going to have to be taken again? Because remember, his soul was sold after those people had committed suicide or died. Now, those people didn't commit suicide because of him. So, therefore, his soul was never suddenly given to the devil. I mean, it gets confusing.
Because when she offers to send him back to the present day, she says, remember, you won't be going back to the present day you left. You'll be going back to the present day projected forward from this.
Yeah, but my
24 hours. Right.
Yeah, but the sins he committed are from that other alternate reality
and
that, before this one. And so the sins that cost him his soul no longer exist. I mean, it's
a Back to the Future timeline.
I had another question. You know, he was born in Cliffordville, right? So why does he have to travel there? For a minute, I thought he might run into himself, but he goes there as if he was a new visitor in town. Nobody knows him. It has a population of 700 and something people, and yet he's treated as a new person, even though he was born in Cliffordville. But then again, it seems like nobody knows each other in Cliffordville, so.
Well, maybe he was born in Cliffordville, left Cliffordville.
I know, but then
like
this thing, it just throws up a lot of questions that don't really get answered, and I think it's all just done to service this plot, and it really doesn't really work. Like I said, I like the acting. You know, I mean, it was interesting, but...
It's almost like him and Hecate switch souls.
It's all speculation, and it's the same old story. I mean, he gets what he deserves, I guess. But that's kind of expected. This guy supposedly, you know, he thinks he can con the devil, but at the end, the devil's like, you know, send me back. Now you realize I'm going to send you back to a future that's predicated on this past. No, send me back. I don't care. You have to sell your thing for $40. Okay. You know, he's making a deal with the devil, even though by now you think he would have known that that's going to be a twist not in his favor. So I don't know. It just felt too familiar. It didn't really feel too original. And, you know, for me, it just really didn't work. It's just like I've seen the story kind of done before, and this thing doesn't really add anything new to it. But I like the acting, and I like Julie Newmar. So for me, I'm going to give it like a 1.5 stars.
All right.
And that's basically what Bobby said.
My God, there is a Santa Claus
after
all.
Yeah. Like you said, Bobby, it's just repeated stuff from the past 3 seasons for season 4. So, yeah. Retread.
Okay, so we've got, what was your rating, Bobby?
Mine? Minus 2.5.
We got minus 2.5. That's not a legitimate rating, you know. -2.5 up to 3. Okay, well, and I give it 2.5, Robert gave it 2.5. Okay, all right, so it goes kind of across the board. That's cool. Okay, I love that. I love that when we have differing opinions. All right, well, yeah, I think we can all agree, though, on one thing. The acting was not bad. And I think even Bobby would say that the acting really, you know, wasn't that bad.
No comment.
Oh. You like Albert Sahmi. He really wasn't that bad.
He was good in war movies. Wasn't he known for war movies and westerns?
Yeah, and you know what he was a regular in? He was a regular in Daniel Boone.
Oh, I remember Daniel Boone. Yeah, I remember
he
that.
He was a regular in that. Yeah. He was in that for years and worked for at least as long as it ran. And I saw him on Bonanza. I've seen him on Gunsmoke. Mm-hmm. He's been on a million things. Yeah, he had a really, you know, he has a huge catalog of credits.
And don't forget, he's a murderer, too.
Mm.
Yes, he's a murderer. But fabulous actor. It's very sad. I mean, something, you know, he snapped or something. He murdered his wife and killed himself. And it's very sad because he really had a great talent. But anyway, that is the way it goes sometimes. And so that's the end of this discussion on this episode. And we will be back after New Year's, actually, on January 4th.
A new year and another wonderful season 4 episode.
Season 4 episode, January 4th. The Incredible World of Horace Ford. Sorry. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And Pat Hingle, he's another good actor, but unfortunately, well, yeah. He did this, but you know, they all
Commissioner Gordon himself, yeah.
Yeah, Commissioner Gordon himself from Batman, and you know, but everybody has to have their duds. Every actor at some point has probably had duds, or most actors. So anyway, what I want to do right now is wish everybody a very, very Merry Christmas and a very, very Happy New Year, and I hope everyone's going to be very safe and healthy over the holidays. And I look forward to seeing everyone again on January 4th. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. So anyway.
Just don't get a box of coal from Santa from FedEx.
I will try very hard not to. But the only one that might give me coal is Bobby. But
how bad was he?
Oh. Santa Claus, why? Why are you taking our Christmas tree? Cindy Lou.
Because it's a screw loose.
And Robert, I hope you get your gift by Christmas. They swore that you would. So if it's not there on Monday or Tuesday, I'm going to be really pissed off.
Well, I thank you guys very much. And
oh,
I'll tell you what, it's been a wonderful year with all you there, you know, everybody in the room. And I wish you all happy holidays, too.
Thank you. And I've and Dave, God to you. My gosh, wonderful.
Cheers,
I wish you a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. What are you doing, Dave? You're gonna be cooking? Are you staying home or what?
I take turns with my mother-in-law, so it's his turn. So I'm having this
awesome
Christmas off. Eating and drinking.
Woo! That's kind of Christmas. There is, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So everybody have a wonderful holiday, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Bye.
Merry Christmas to all of you.
Merry Christmas to you. Have a happy New Year.
You too. I enjoy being part of the group now.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, and you have a great time. Hey, you've got kids, right?
Yeah, I do. So I'll be spending it with them and with some in-laws, and it'll be chaos, but it'll be fun.
Of course it will. Oh, that's wonderful.
You know how chaos there's order, at least. Not
well,
the teen years. I don't know about that.
Well, have a great holiday, Lou. Okay.
All right, yeah, all of you too, yeah.
Thank you. See you in 2 weeks.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away. Here we are, as in olden days. Happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who are dear to us, gather near to us once more. Through the years, the fates allow, hang a shining star upon the highest bough, and have yourself a merry
stay tuned for an extra holiday treat of Talking Twilight Zone, a bonus episode, Night of the Meek. Everybody have a wonderful holiday, and talk to you next year.
Live.
Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
Blimey, who's in?
That's Father Christmas.
A pagan Father Christmas.
And he sends his best to you too, Governor.
Yes, Father.
Such Father Christmas.
Christmas, Father Christmas. He's the meanest man in the old wide world. In the old wide world, you can feel it.
He's a miser. He's a skimpy.
He's a stingy lout. He's a stocking out for your Christmas gift. Come and steal it. It's a shame. He's a villain. What a guy for a villain to play on Christmas Day. After Christmas, on Christmas, we'll be just as mean as he's ever been. And I'm here to say we should all send Father Christmas. on his Merry Christmas Day.
He's a rascal. He's a bandit.
He's a crafty one. Leave your door undone. He'll go in your house and sell it.
It's a crime.
It's a scandal. What a game for a vandal to play on Christmas Day.
Open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Hi there, folks. My name is Lynn. I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone, and I also want to welcome my co-hosts, Bobby Neer and Robert. Hi, guys.
Howdy, howdy.
Hello.
Hello, Dave. And today's episode is titled Night of the Meek, and I will turn it over to Robert for the opening clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
This may look to you like any dismal, dark, and dingy alley that lies skulking off the million myriad shadow places off the main drags. Actually, it's the private domain of leprechauns and elves, and supplies the locale of Twilight Zone. With us for a very special occasion is Mr. Art Carney, who plays the role of a department store Santa Claus. And he plays it with the heart, the warmth, and the vast talent that is uniquely Carney. On the Twilight Zone, the Night of the Meek.
Okay, thank you, Robert. And before I begin, I want to welcome Steve Law. And, of course, I want to welcome our good friend Dave from England, also one of our resident guest hosts, or guest co-hosts, I should say, and also Kelly. And I think someone else we just got here. Nope, I guess not. But I would like to welcome you all, and thanks for being here. And also, before I start, I wanted to mention that I've been trying to shorten my episode summaries, you know, condense them so they'd condense them a little more so they don't go on too long as they sometimes have in the past, because just about everyone here has seen the episodes, and for anyone who hasn't, well, the summary can and should give the general plot in a short amount of time. So I'm going to try to keep them pretty short, because we all know that a summary should be a brief, concise description of something, not a play-by-play detailed retelling of the story. So you've seen it, you don't need to hear it all again, and I don't want you to get bored. So with that, here is a brief summary of Night of the Meek. Henry Corwin is a street bum whose best friend is the bottom of a bottle. He takes a job as a department store Santa, but gets fired on Christmas Eve when he shows up for work intoxicated. He leaves with his tail between his legs and a broken spirit until he ends up finding a magic sack in an alley. Suddenly, he becomes Santa when he starts pulling gifts out of the sack, and they turn out to be exactly what people in need really want, what the poor and the needy really want. Well, the police come and they arrest him for possessing stolen goods. But when they open the sack, all they find is garbage inside the sack. So they release Henry and he starts passing out gifts again until the sack is empty. After seeing how much joy he's brought to the poor and homeless, he wishes he could do this every Christmas. He walks back through the alley later that night and he's approached by an elf with a sleigh and a reindeer waiting to take him to the North Pole. So his wish was granted. Henry has really become Santa and can spread joy and happiness every holiday season. So that is the brief summary of Night of the Meek. And I think for everyone pretty much has seen that episode who's here. But, you know, at our Twilight Zone group, the ratings at the poll for this episode are all over the place. They range from lousy to average to classic and every rating in between. Now, I gave it an average rating. I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it. This is the only holiday episode of The Twilight Zone that Rod Serling ever wrote. And according to Serling himself in a TV Guide interview, the idea came from watching a Christmas parade with his two kids. He noticed that the man playing Santa on the parade float looked like a last-minute choice because he was very thin and his Santa suit was disheveled, his hair was disheveled. And Serling then realized that perhaps there's an interesting story lurking somewhere in the whole concept of these guys who play Santa for a living. So he started to work on a tale of a fake Santa who suddenly becomes the real thing. But I couldn't give it any higher than an average rating because this episode had one of the most predictable endings of any of the zones that they've done. I think most people knew he was going to become Santa Claus at the end. And the storyline has been copied a few times in the years after Night of the Meek. A thinly veiled copy of the storyline can be seen in the early 90s movie The Santa Claus, starring Tim Allen. So there were no real surprises for me in this one. I knew how it was going to end, and you know, it left nothing to my imagination. And, you know, it was obvious, and it just didn't blow me away. All of the acting was good, though. I think Serling's casting of R. Carney in the role was right on the mark. The man is a terrific actor, and I've loved his work ever since his role as Ed Norton in The Honeymooners. In fact, this Zone episode reunited Serling and R. Carney and the director, Jack Smite, because Carney starred in one of Rod Serling's Playhouse 90 episodes called The Velvet Alley, which Jack Smite directed. And I do believe that the Playhouse 90 episode was sort of a vague story of Serling himself. When Rod Serling wrote it, he was kind of writing it about himself because it is about a writer. One other little piece of trivia. I think everybody a lot of people know that A Nightmare as a Child, that episode that was from season one, starring Janice Rule. Well, Janice Rule's character was named after his favorite teacher, Helen Foley. Well, in this episode, R. Carney's character, Henry Corwin, was named after Rod Serling's idol, writer Norman Corwin. So that's just a little extra trivia to throw out there. And so, as I said, I gave it an average rating, and with that, I'll turn it over to Robert.
So, Henry didn't go on to work in the sewers. Oh, no, that's a different show. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I noticed the ratings for this one was kind of a mixed bag as well. What kind of puzzles me is this show's kind of a mystery in a sense of why do we only do one Christmas show out of five seasons and that's it. You know, this felt more of a season one than it did a season two episode. Maybe it wasn't popular enough to where they didn't have a season one every year. I think they should have tried to do one every year, to be honest about it. It's kind of weird just to throw, you know, something in there and say, well, that's it, and then, you know, don't go back to it again. I guess it's like season four. But anyway, it was okay. I mean, I remember this when I was a kid. I kind of gave it a good rating because I thought I could do much better than the bum R. Carney could in this one. When I was a kid, you know, shoot, you know, he becomes Santa. Why heck could I be Santa? But, yeah, this one kind of had the memory in mind for me. You know, I agree it is kind of a one or two, but, you know, it tugs at my heartstring a little bit when I watch it. And here I'm coming from the stance of, well, you know, I never seen it originally because last year the Twilight Zone was when I was born. So, the only things I have to go on is reference to other things that I've seen. What's interesting, too, is that I ain't going to go into the whole detail, too, like Lynn was saying about the whole story. I mean, we've seen it. We pretty much know what it's about. So I decided to do a comparison to the 1985 version. Yes, folks, there was a remake of Night of the Meek in 1985 when they revived Twilight Zone, and it had Richard Mulligan in it as Henry. In that one, it kind of followed along the same line as the original one, but they did have some variances in the story in the 85 version. I noticed that the thing about Sister Florence and the mission where Henry goes to give out the presents there, and then she goes and runs to the police through, you know, the Officer Flaherty to talk about the stuff that Henry was passing out as Santa. In the 85 version, that one was cut out. And in the 85 version, it's pretty much Henry is in his apartment. After hearing carolers sing outside his window, he takes the trash out and notices that the trash bag, not the burlap sack in the original one, but the trash bag was giving out gifts. And so instead of the mission situation in the original, then he goes on to pass out the presents in his apartment. And Mr. Dundee character is in this one as well. He is the owner of the store. He's riding home. He finds he's wondering what all the commotion was and stops at Henry's apartment. So we also have the police situation. He doesn't go to jail in 85-1. The police come there. And the scene that I'm going to play next from the 85 is where after all of what's happened in Henry's life, they're sitting outside the steps. We remember the original one. It was the old man that comes out with his pipe as the present that he got from Henry and sitting on the steps and asking him the question about what, you know, why didn't he get what he wanted? Well, the 85 version, you have Mr. Dundee asking that question.
These gifts didn't come from your store. We both know that.
And where?
Never question miracles.
That's the cult.
It's my wife's coat.
And something for you.
Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris.
Are these autographs real?
I bet they are.
These are all the 61 Yankees?
Corwin. What about you?
Nothing for yourself.
This night was my gift, and I couldn't have received anything more perfect. Unless you would be
to live this magic every year.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Dundee!
Kind of get the difference in ending in the 85 than we get from the 1960 version. Little girl elf that appears in the 60 version is missing from this one. Basically, we see the magic at the end to where the reference of the Santa Claus is brought up from Lynn, where he actually turns into Santa Claus and goes up the chimney in the 85 version. That's kind of how they ended that one. If you break this down, it's almost like a genie in the bottle situation again, as Bobby referred to in other stories where you have a wish or a thought and Santa grabs it out of the bag and there it is. One of the things I focused on, I haven't put my review up yet, but I'm going to put it up later on here, is Santa himself. How does Santa carry on from the centuries? And it's kind of an interesting thought. You know, Santa and Mrs. Claus, they have children. Is the heritage patched on to the child itself, or just simply if something happens to Santa, it's almost like Doctor Who, if something happens to Santa, does someone else takes his place situation with this? And a couple of clips that I got, one is, as Lynn mentioned, Santa Claus, Tim Allen's first movie, a real good first movie at that, because it pretty much set Tim Allen in the movies for later on, doing Toy Story and other movies, so here's the trailer for that.
Here's a ladder.
Somebody's on the roof.
Maybe it's Santa.
Not now, Charlie.
This Christmas, Scott Calvin's getting into the spirit the only way he can.
Hey, you!
By accident.
If something should happen to me, put on my suit, the reindeer will know what to do.
He's Santa! He killed him!
Did not.
Hang out, Santa!
Hooray! When you put on the suit, he felt subject to the Santa Claus.
The Santa Claus?
What does that mean? It means you put on the suit, you're the big guy.
Ha! Santa? Tucking your clothes is so baggy.
Do you want this doll or not? Go back to sleep. I shave in the morning, in the afternoon, I look like this.
Oh, my God.
Calvin, you wait. What happened?
Bee sting.
What, you put on a little weight? Does this look like a little weight to you?
You look distressed.
I'm way past distressed. I'm talking to an elf.
He's not Santa.
Oh, my God.
He is too Santa.
Wait, I'm not done.
Fax me.
This is our perpetrator. This one's not going to be easy to find.
Won't the bright red suit and beard give him away?
Who's down there?
Santa, you're Father this year.
Have a piece of fruit, for God's sake.
This holiday season,
it's coming!
Tim Allen is giving till it hurts.
Johnny, naughty. Gary, nice. Veronica, very nice.
The Santa Claus.
You're a 1,200-year-old elf?
You look pretty good for your age.
Thanks, but I'm seeing someone in wrapping.
If anybody's seen the Santa Claus, you see your Tim Allen mouth okay after that. But a wonderful movie, one of my favorites during the Christmas season. One of the best I think Tim Allen did. Also, how did Santa come to be? And there was a movie that tried to attempt that. It was Santa Claus the Movie, came out in 1985. And we get to hear a Twilight Zone alumni, Burgess Meredith, in the beginning of this one. So here's that trailer for that one.
Prophecy has come to pass that there would come to us a chosen one, and that he himself would be an artist and a skilled maker of toys. From this day on, now and forever, you will bring our gifts to all the children in all the world. This is your legacy and your gift, as is the gift of flight.
It's them!
Every year, the magic happens again.
Merry Christmas!
It certainly should be.
Until now.
What are you?
I'm an elf.
An elf?
Yes.
You mean, like, a fairy?
I mean, I'm talking modern methods of production here. I'm talking assembly line. I'm talking way for the future.
Now someone wants to take the magic out of Christmas.
We say, bigger, better, it's going to cost you.
Cost who?
The people who buy the toy.
Well, nothing. We're going to give them away free.
For free?
Well, that's how we do it at the North Pole.
Well, that's not how we do it here.
Santa Claus is finished.
I just wanted him to see what a good assistant I could be.
Only one man can stop him. Only one man can help us. And he's coming to take you for a sleigh ride in the stars. Alexander Salkind presents Dudley Moore and John Lithgow. The legend comes to life for the very first time. With all the magic, all the adventure, all the wonder. Santa Claus, the movie. Seeing is believing.
With that one, also, John Lithgow played the third segment in the Twilight Zone movie. He played the William Shatner role in that one. Yeah, this one tried to tell the history of Santa Claus, from being a wood carver to finding the North Pole. And John Lithgow was kind of the over-the-top villain in that movie, but here again, there were some examples of Santa Claus himself, and as I said earlier, kind of a genie in a bottle type formula situation, except for sack. So there's my little clip I threw in for you there, Bobby, to pass over there, since I know you're a Yankees fan, so I'm going to pass it over to you.
Thank you very much, Robert. Well, there's only one thing I can say after all these touchy-feely remarks on the board and everywhere about this episode and how sweet it is and how nice it is, and that is bah humbug. I don't like it at all. I never did. Yes, that's a good one, yeah. I never did like it. It doesn't do a thing for me, and there's just nothing there. I mean, anybody could have written it. It's not. No outstanding writing in it, and Lynn is certainly right when she indicates that you can predict what's going to happen from the minute it starts. Anytime you see a character, especially dressed as Santa, who's lurching around as a drunk, you can certainly predict that he will be redeemed at the end by Christmas spirit, because people watching at home did not want to see it any other way, so you know how it's going to end. You may not know that he's going to turn into actual Santa Claus, but you can pretty much see where it's going. So this story just doesn't do anything for me. It's not the worst episode of the series. We still have some of those in front of us, unfortunately. But I think what really hurts for me right now is that it's one of a succession of really poor stories in season two that seem to be endless. Started out back a month or so ago with that one with Inger Stevens about being a robot. And we had that. We had the guy with the radio last time. And we had the one with the idiots with the camera, and now we've got this. And it just goes from week to week. It surprises me that the Twilight Zone managed to survive this really kind of dip in the road here, because in these four stories, I don't see anything that even looks like the Twilight Zone.
And the video didn't help, neither did it, Bobby.
What didn't help?
The look didn't help at all.
Oh, no, not at all. No. And I just think, I wonder if you could get away with that today on TV, where things come and go in a heartbeat. If you don't go from week to week and grab everybody, they'll pull you out of there in a minute. So certainly
kind
of lucky.
Well, you know, it didn't grab everybody back then, Bob. I thought it was a good episode. Not great, not awful.
Right.
But I thought it was pretty good. If I can chime in, I'm sorry, by the way.
That's all right. No, that's fine.
No, that's fine.
That's not my type of story. So I don't have a whole lot to say about it, but I did find some interesting things about Art Carney. Now, of course, everybody knows about Art Carney being in The Honeymooners. And in fact, if you go to IMDb, there's a lot of information about Art Carney. And Jackie Gleason says on there that, or said at the time, that he was 90% of the reason why The Honeymooners was a success. And I don't doubt that. And but there's some interesting things. Now, in this story, he plays a down-and-out alcoholic who's trying to be Santa Claus. But and I didn't know this. Maybe everybody does but me. But Art Carney actually was an alcoholic at one time. It says here in IMDb,
yeah.
he was the original Felix in The Odd Couple on Broadway, and he had to leave the show because he suffered a nervous breakdown over the end of his 25-year marriage to wife Joan due to his addictions to alcohol, amphetamines, and barbiturates. And he recovered in the 70s, and he of course won an Oscar for Harry and Tano, and then they got remarried. So it's a remarkable story, but. Now, my question would be, since this, when is this episode, Lynn? Was it 60?
60,
Yeah,
so 5 years later, I seriously doubt that he suddenly became addicted to all these things just because he had marital problems. So maybe, because it says here, due to his addictions, he may have had this as a long-standing thing. So,
Actually, Bobby, I don't doubt the alcoholism, but some of the other, the drug, okay, let me back up a little bit. A lot of us in the business think that the IMDb is the idiot's movie database.
Well, thank you. I've never been so complimented. Thank you.
Because there's a lot of inaccuracies. There's a lot of home movies on it that never went anywhere. A lot of the quote-unquote details of people are not true. As a matter of fact, at one point, I think Spielberg wanted to sue them for something. So a lot of us take what the IMDb says about people with a grain of salt.
Well,
the alcoholism, maybe, but the others, like I said, I'm not sure.
Well, I don't doubt that. There's a lot on the internet that you can't believe, so that doesn't surprise me in the least.
Right. Yeah.
But at any rate, whether he was able to portray an alcoholic because he wasn't one in real life, or he just did a good job, or because he was a good actor, is you know, who knows? I don't know which way it was. But I
maybe talk about Charlie Sheen like that too, Bobby.
Well, I got a reverse thing.
What's that?
You guys have heard of Jason Robards?
Heard of what?
Jason Robards, the actor.
Oh, Jason
Robards.
Okay. One of his sons from his first wife is my best friend. I've known him since I was like 13. He was an alcoholic, and you could never tell with his acting, but yet on almost every movie, he was drunk.
That doesn't surprise me. There are actors who are able to do that, overcome their addictions. That wouldn't be, I thought Charlie Sheen was very good in Wall Street and
definitely.
And yet he's a lunatic. So I mean, it doesn't. Sometimes they're able to put that aside.
Or even Robert Downey Jr. I mean, the case is over. Place.
Yeah.
Bobby, go ahead and finish up here. Go ahead, Bobby.
Other thing I found at IMDb, and of course this might be a lot of BS too, is that Art Carney was such a great voiceover artist. He did voiceovers for a lot of things. That he actually during his fireside chats, Franklin Roosevelt was too ill, it was Art Carney imitating his voice instead, and nobody even knew it. Now, I don't know whether they made this up or not. That's the first time I've ever heard about it. It says here, he was such a talented voice artist that he sometimes substituted for President Franklin Roosevelt in his famous fireside chats when Roosevelt was too ill to speak. So, and I didn't really know that Carney was known so much for his voice. So that's another thing that's there. Whether
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I've never heard that. So now that I've heard that only idiots look at IMDb, I don't know. No.
I didn't say only idiots. I said that that's what we call it in the business. That's all I said.
Anyway.
I said we call it the idiot movie database. I didn't say people that work there are.
Okay, well, maybe they should change the name, just keep the letters the same. Anyway, as far as the episode is concerned, it's always fun to see Art Carney. Harry and Tano, I've only seen once. I haven't seen it in years, so I don't even remember it. He actually won an Oscar for that. He beat out Jack Nicholson, Dustin Hoffman, and Al Pacino that year. He beat out Al Pacino for The Godfather, too. So, I mean, that's quite impressive. There's no doubt about the man's talent. But that's another thing that bothers me about this story, is that if you're going to have Art Carney in it, or any famous actor or comic or anybody, I would think you would do a better story. I don't think it shows him at his best. I don't want to sit for 23 minutes watching him just lurching around, sitting at a bar. That's kind of poor. I would expect more than that. So, basically, story doesn't do much for me. Is it the worst? No, I gave it a 1. I usually, lately, as everybody knows, I've been giving a lot of things 0. So I would give it a 1, probably mainly because he's in it more than for any other reason. There are worse things. We got one coming up soon that's absolutely dreadful. So, it could be better, it could be worse. Lynn tells me somebody in our poll section called it a classic, which I find absolutely astonishing.
Two people
rated it as classic. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
people.
If that's a classic, I sure would like to know what Time Enough Alas is. So
I think some people might consider it a classic because it was the only Christmas episode that Sterling ever did. So they might.
No,
think,
that's not
you know,
to
they make
it the best because
that,
it's the only
that's
one.
That's not
well,
true.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
There's a couple.
Yeah. Well, see, I would have just thought maybe because they figured that's the only Twilight's an episode that was ever Christmas related or holiday related, so they voted classic for that, but I don't know if that's true, but that's what I would think.
I would love to make it a classic, but it fell short for me. It's a leap to make it a 3.
Yeah. I made an average just because the ending was so predictable. Oh, by the way, I'd like to welcome Eiffel and guest number 12, and of course Rick Wall. Welcome to everybody who's here. And so, Bobby, anything else to add on that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I watched it at the beginning of the week for the first time in many, many years. And although I got through it, I didn't like it. And it's the only thing now that can make me look back upon the Oscar awards on TV several weeks ago with fondness. That actually was more fascinating than this is. Only because it was so dreadfully bad and almost funny. That's it for me, Lynn.
Okay. And now we're going to turn it over to Dave.
Not a lot to say on this one, but I probably agree more with Bobby on this one than I have on any of the other episodes recently.
Someday at the Idiots Database, we can look through it together.
I'm not really fond of these Christmas specials. Robert will know I'm not really keen in when Doctor Who, when they do the Christmas specials. Because they spend, not in this case, but in that, they spend a lot of extra money on it, and they seem to sort of hold back money from standard episodes so they can have a lavish Christmas one, and I'd much rather have a decent budget given to the series as a whole. The only thing I would say when Lynn were mentioning about how it's been done to death, this idea in a way, I do fairly strongly feel that when you're watching something that was made in 1960, you sort of can't downgrade it, because that idea was reused in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and whatever. Because the people making it at the time had no, foreknowledge of those, repetitions that then weaken any plot. I'm not necessarily saying that this plot was weakened by it, because it was such a sort of cozy, homely, Christmassy type of plot. But I do always feel as though you've got to think that anything that happened after an episode aired can't be used necessarily to criticise the episode. You can always say, well, it was done better in 1970, or it was done better when it was revisited 10 years later. But you can't sort of criticise the people for not knowing that it was going to be done better 10 years later, if that makes sense. Art Carney apparently played Santa again in 1984 in a TV movie, The Night They Saved Christmas. Thought that was a little bit interesting. The blonde at the bar, there was very brief appearance and I don't think she spoke, Nan Peterson, was in 4 Twilight Zones. So she's somewhat of a record, well, not a record, but obviously had a little bit of a thing going there. But the person I'd really like to talk about is the chap who played Mr. Dundee, the John Friedler, is it? I remember him from 12 Angry Men, which apparently I hadn't realised was one of his first roles, and that was, I think that was 1957, prior to this one. So, and I thought he was excellent in that.
He was also in Star Trek Original, too.
He was in Star Trek Original, as was Meg Wiley, the lady who played Sister Florence. She was in the very first episode, The Cage. But John Friedler was also...
He did a lot of character acting. He was a great character actor.
He was the voice of Piglet from Winnie the Pooh, and he was in a lot of Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, Tigger the Movie. And so, and again, I'm not knowledgeable on this. I am reading from Wiki and assuming that it is, for this instance, correct. So not a lot really to say, except to say that I did, when I was catching this up, by accident, watch the middle section, and it turned out to be the remake, the 1980s remake, which I didn't think was as good. And one thing about that, which I ought to mention, is the chap who played Mr. Dundee in that was played by William Alterton, I think that's how you pronounce his name, who actually I thought is a reasonably good actor from films I've seen him in. I remember him, he played the reporter in the Die Hard movies, the one that was the prat on the aeroplane that was always trying to get him in trouble. And he was in the Pelican Brief and even in Ghostbusters and quite a number of films. But if you were watching his acting in this, you wouldn't have thought he would have such an illustrious career ahead of him, because as Mr. Dundee, he certainly wasn't as good as the John Friedler character in the early movie. So not a lot to say. I'm not really a great fan of Christmas Present. It was adequate. And I'm vying between giving it 1 or 2 points. Probably 2 points, because it was not harmful. But again, I'm going to finish on agreeing with Bobby, because I want to cheer the guy up. I agree with him up to now. Series 2 does seem to be a watered-down series.
Okay.
I think Series 3 starts picking up. That seems to be where they hit their stride.
But what I mean by watered-down, I mean, not many of them have packed a real punch. There's been the twist and the tail, but there's not been anything really hard-hitting.
Earth-shattering, yeah.
Right, right. Well, thank you for that, Dave. And our former co-host, Kelly, is here, and I know she wants to give her thoughts. So, Kelly, hi there.
Hello. Yes, and I want to say hello to the new members that have joined our Twilight Zone group on the Internet. This is your other co-moderator, Kelly, talking. And I just want to start off by saying I am the dissenting voice here, because I disagree with pretty much everybody about this episode. I did not rank it a classic. I gave it I believe I gave it a 4 for excellent, because I really couldn't find a lot to dislike about it. I would put this episode into a category that I tend to refer to as one of the lighter fare episodes. And I do agree that when we get these episodes that are kind of more to be a little bit lighter, maybe have more humor in them, I think so far most of them have not been all that great. But I really did not mind this. I thought Art Carney was very touching in this role. I felt a lot of empathy for him. The one thing about his character, Henry, it would have been nice if we could have found out a little bit more about Henry. Just as I would have been curious to know how it was Henry ended up where he was. You know, what, obviously something happened in his life to put him into this situation of being alcoholic and down on his luck. But it was clearly, obviously, he liked kids. you know, and you kind of had to, I kind of found myself wondering, did this man lose his family at some point? Is this why he ended up like this?
It's missing a backstory, I agree.
Yeah, and it's, you know, because certainly he was, you know, he does not come across as necessarily a bad person. He certainly doesn't seek out to mess up. He legitimately felt badly when he got fired from his job. And some of the scenes in there I thought were very good, because there was the scene where the mother calls to the manager and says the guy is drunk, and she starts saying all kinds of stuff that he was rude, and he said, and he actually sticks up for himself and he says, I was not rude to this woman. Now, you want to fire me for insubordination because I was late coming back to work, fair enough, but let the record show I was not rude to that customer. And I just, you know, and I liked John, I did like John Fiedler a lot as Dundee. Pretty much anything I've ever seen him in, I've always enjoyed him. I've seen him in several things from that era, and he's always a wonderful actor to see. Just because he's such an unassuming and soft-spoken guy, you're just not really sure what's going to happen with him, but he's a very good character actor. I liked the scene at the police station. I thought it was very cute when they, you know, when Dundee comes in there and wants to file charges against him for stealing, but of course they just find garbage. And one of the bits in there that I thought was great was when he opened up the sack and the cat jumped out. I mean, it was a nice little play on the cats out of the bag. I thought that was just priceless. And the look on John Fiedler's face when Henry asks him, what is it that you would like? And he says, okay, fine. I'd like a bottle of 1903 cherry brandy. And he reaches in there and he grabs it and he hands it to him and wishes him a Merry Christmas. And I thought that bit was great. The look on John Fiedler's face and the other cop in the police precinct was great, and they decide they're going to open up that bottle of brandy and get hammered with it on Christmas Eve. I thought that was very good. And I also do disagree a little bit in the predictability of the ending, because we have seen other episodes that kind of hint that this could have gone a different way. For example, in season one, you had that episode called The Stop at Willoughby, where you have the James Daly character who is getting off the train and he's walking into this pristine, serene place. And at the end of the, at the end of the show, you find him in the snow dead. Well, that could have just as easily happened in this episode. I mean, this was not a show that aired during the family hour. I know that Rod Serling got some nasty letters from some parents saying that they were very angry that he had portrayed a Santa Claus as a drunk. But by the same token, this is a show that aired at 10 p.m., so I doubt very much that there were very many little kids who watched that show and got traumatized by it. But because this show aired at 10 p.m. on a Friday night, he could have easily taken a much darker ending to this. I mean, we could have had it where the whole thing at the end happened, and it was Henry's hallucination as he was dying. We could have seen him at the end drunk or basically dead in the alley, as they were finding his body. But in his mind, you know, he has ascended and he's now living the life that he wants to. But in reality, for the rest of the world, Henry actually died in the alley. So certainly we could have seen a much darker ending. And I think it's good that we had a nicer ending, because after all, it's Christmas. Who wants to get really depressed?
Yeah, I couldn't see Rod Serling killing off, even if it wasn't not in Family Hour. I couldn't see him killing off Santa or somebody playing Santa 2 days before Christmas.
You know what? Certainly that was an option, and it wouldn't surprise me if Rod Serling actually thought of the idea and then thought, nah, we can't do that. But you know, in today's world, who's to say somebody wouldn't write something like that? You could, the sky's the limit. After all, it's the Twilight Zone.
Well, we got to remember we had that Miracle on 34th Street, the original one, where the Santa was drunk in the Macy's Christmas parade, too.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
Right.
They fired on
right.
Yeah.
So I thought it was good. There was really nothing for me to dislike in it. I mean, okay, it was kind of predictable, but I thought the overall message was good. I liked the positive aspect of it. And, we don't really get to see a nice ending very often in the Twilight Zone. So I figure, why not enjoy it? And actually, we did have one other one that sort of was Christmas-oriented, but you don't find out it's Christmas-oriented till the very, very end of the episode. That was from Season 3, Five Characters in Search of an Exit, when you find out at the end.
Well, yeah, that was the very last.
But they're actually toys for a Christmas toy drive. But you don't find that out till the last 5 minutes of the episode. So that was the only other time that you actually see them delve into a holiday. And I suspect the reason why we only saw one holiday episode was because after this, showing Santa Claus, what can you really follow it with? You could have taken pretty much any other episode that they did and set it at Christmas time, but I don't know that it would have really had the same effect. So it's kind of a nice little standalone episode, and I think I thought it was good. I gave it an excellent rating. So that's pretty much all I have to say on it.
Go ahead, Rick Wall. Sorry.
I said not everybody disagrees with you. I forgot to give my rating. Can we give half points?
Sure.
Like,
go ahead.
Like 4.5?
We just recently added that to the rating system, 4.5.
Okay.
Yes, you can. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's my
can.
Rating for this episode.
That's certainly entitled to that. You're entitled to that opinion. Oh, I'd like to welcome Felix in New Jersey. Welcome, Felix. Oh, you're certainly entitled to that opinion. You're not alone. I mean, there were people who gave it classic, good, excellent. I mean, it ran the gamut. It really did. You know, it was one of those ones that it was all over the board.
And that's actually, I think, a good thing. I mean, if everybody always holds the same opinion, that's kind of dull. The conversation stops early on the board when that
right,
happens.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
I mean,
so anybody else?
It was an attempt, which was too bad that, as Kelly was saying, that they didn't do one each year. I think it would have been nice if they tried to do one each year, but it kind of felt out of place in the second season. This felt more like a season one where this one should have been placed. I mean, it was written Sterling, so.
Yeah, that's true. Well, as I told you in my review there, this came out of the blue. You know, he's watching a parade with his kids, and this totally un-Santa-like person is on the Santa float, very thin, very disheveled, and he just said, well, this looks like somebody they just grabbed at the last minute because the original Santa couldn't make it, and, he's thinking there's got to be a story behind these guys, that do these jobs, and that's how the story came about. So, it was pretty interesting how he comes up with these ideas. He just sees something, and there it is, there's a new Twilight Zone. So I thought that was pretty cool.
I would recommend everybody to check out the 85 version just for giggles,
to see
the difference.
Does anybody know why the 85 version was made?
No.
Well, it was made in season 2.
Why it was made.
Well, why, yeah. I have no idea.
Okay.
Season 1, episode 13A.
So. Harlan Ellison wanted to put in a story called Knuckles. Where Knuckles is Santa's brother. He hates Christmas. He has a sleigh propelled by bulls. And instead of gifts, he goes down and kills people.
Oh, jeez.
So the network said no. Absolutely not. We can't put a Christmas episode on where Santa Claus kills people.
Wonder why.
That's when Harlan got pissed off, as he usually does, especially at people on TV, and said, you know what? I was a producer of this piece of garbage. from now on, take my name off of it. I'm not doing a damn thing with it. Goodbye.
Wow.
I think it was just something Rick Waldie wanted to throw in because we remember
they had nothing else to do. So you're right. They threw it in.
Right.
Because they had shot about 60% of the Knuckles episode.
Well, let me explain that. It's one of three of that episode. It was episode 13A, which ran 22 minutes, 18 seconds. And then they had But She Can Type, and there was another one that went in with that. And it aired December 20th, 1985.
Right.
So they thought, well, we need to throw a Christmas one in. We'll grab one from 1960.
No. Again, I repeat, no. That's why they redid it, yes. But, like I said, they had shot and done a lot of the Knuckles episode, and then the network comes in and says, no, you're not showing this. We're not showing this with this episode. So the other producers caved and said, okay, we'll cut it out. And then they go, great, what do we do now? And somebody said, well, let's remake this one, and they did.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, I give it 2 out of 5 for the 85. It was okay.
Well, if
we're
actually,
Art Carney would be better.
I mean, I would say this: the original one rates better to me than the remake. So perhaps I ought to go firmly to 2, not between 1 and 2.
I would think Art Carney would be, a little. I mean, I like Richard Mulligan. Don't get me wrong, but I guess I like Art Carney a little better, and I think he's better for this episode.
And it's too bad it's the only one he did too, Lynn. It would have been nice seeing him in some other episodes.
Yeah, because Rod Serling, he had a thing about using the same actors over and over again in his episodes.
Right.
Even the character actors, even the ones who weren't stars.
Jack Klugman, Burgess Meredith, I mean,
exactly.
Line goes on.
Well,
yeah.
That's because Burgess and him were friends, and Burgess actually did not get paid for a lot of them. He's volunteered to do a lot of them.
I read that before.
Friendship
that's true.
With him.
That's true.
A lot of the actors at that time did so. I think Klugman
did it
was
out of
one. Yep.
Yeah, I read that somewhere too. But also some of the character actors they use because that woman in The Fever, Vivi Janis, who plays the wife of the husband who can't take the gambling. He can't stand gambling, but then he gets addicted to the machine. Vivi Janis.
The Fever.
Fever. Right. She was in about 2 or 3 episodes. And played basically character parts in the other ones. And there's also the one guy, Penny for Your Thoughts. Penny for Your Thoughts, the guy who plays the banker who they think is going to, steal money from the bank. I forget his name now, but he's an old character actor, and he played in about 3 or 4 of the Twilight Zone episodes, but basically in, supporting parts. So, yeah, Rod Serling did like to use his actors over and over again.
Yeah. We had Nick York in a couple. We had Ingrid Stieglitz in a couple.
Yeah.
He says in chat, William Chapner. Yeah. So.
Exactly. And even the guy who played the sailor and the hitchhiker was just in The Most Unusual Camera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the guy who played the brother. Woodrow. That's it, Woodrow. He played the sailor and the hitchhiker. Yeah, he did like to use his people more than once. If he liked you, you had a job. So, anybody else?
Lynn, I'd like to add something.
Sure.
I'd like to make a formal invitation to any other idiots out there listening to this show to join me at IMDb anytime because I spend a lot of my time there. I'll see them there because I always say you can never be too misinformed.
He's not going to let you live this down, Rick. You know that.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Go to my class reunion this year, or actually school reunion. I'm going to probably be pelted with, Rick, what does the NRA stand for? National Recovery Act? Because in a history paper in high school, I put National Rifle Association wrong.
I was thinking I
put the wrong Roosevelt. I mean, the wrong thing with the wrong Roosevelt. And my history teacher was like, What?
I guess Franklin and Teddy can get confusing there.
Yeah. This is a job application for IMDb, then, is it?
And he is and he is now the headmaster. So.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, I think we.
Yeah,
we
should wrap up the show. It's getting to be as long as Titanic
was.
If nobody else
has anything to add, I guess we're done now. We will be back in 2 weeks. Robert, what's our next episode?
It will be Dust, the 26th.
Dust on the 26th of March. Okay. So we will see everyone in 2 weeks, and that will be March 26th for Dust. I hope to see you all there. And we are wrapping this one up, so have a great weekend, everybody. See ya.
You too.
Bye.
And we'll finish up with Rod here.
A word to the wise to all the children of the 20th century, whether their concern be pediatrics or geriatrics, whether they crawl on hands and knees and wear diapers, or walk with a cane and comb their beards. There's a wondrous magic to Christmas, and there's a special power reserved for little people. In short, there's nothing mightier than the meek.